I was very pleased word had reached me that this was being called book camp. And I was a little fearful that it might be like other summer camps. I was afraid that we'd show up this morning and have to do calisthenics. So I'm delighted to learn that that's not the case. I don't have to do deep knee bends or push-ups or that sort of thing, but I did walk in, and for this was a first. I'm completely wired. I'm now wired, and there's a camera on me, and I think perhaps if I say something inappropriate, I will explode before your eyes. There's a big panel up there, and I suspect there may be a detonation device on there. A button that says canceled, and if pushed, I'll just, so if I vaporize, scratch out what I just said in the preceding moments. No, it's an honor to be here, as always, and a joy to come back to be here at the seminary and get a chance to talk. We're going to cover a lot of ground in the next few weeks. And there is a way in which, what we're going to be doing is a bit of what the Scandinavians call smorgasbord. With my Norwegian background, I know it well. It's a meal that they prepare where there are many and various dishes, and then you wander through and you're able to grab a little of this, a little of that, and some other. And the dishes do not always seem to connect, but by the time you've finished eating, you've had a lot to eat. You've had a lot of different tastes. We devised this seminar in that way. We're covering, well, close to 500 years, more than that, 700 years of literature. We are looking at individual works from across the centuries. We're covering all sorts of different genres. Given my propensities and the fact that I teach literature, but music is really probably my great love. It's what I do in private. It's what no one will pay me for, but what I enjoy doing. I've also managed to sneak an opera in here, so we're going to be doing all sorts of different things. But I want to begin, and this first talk this morning, I hope to at least wander a little ways into the inferno, although it may have to wait till the 11 o'clock hour. We'll see how far I get. We will give you time between to digest some of this, assuming you get any food at all that is digestible. We'll find out about that. But I want to make some introductory remarks about literature, but preceding that about the nature of art itself. And when I use art now, I'm not referring just to paintings or sculpture. I'm using art in the larger context of those things which are created. Literature, music, paintings, sculpture. They all get put together under this big category which is called art. And in another way, art has always been there as a manifestation of the human spirit. But as Catholics, we also know art has always been there as an extension of the glories of the Catholic faith. I insist on reminding students, because it's a great truth, that most of what we take for the glories of Western art, as we call it, they all grow out of the Mass. From the architecture and the building of the great cathedrals, to the great paintings when Western art dawns after the Classical Age. It dawns, of course, with those magnificent religious paintings. Music begins to take on a life of its own as it grows out of the Gregorian chant. I was just in Italy a few weeks ago talking about the medieval drama and talking at length about the way in which drama grows out of the Mass itself. And indeed, it's quite true that what we know is the English drama, or any really of the drama after the Greeks, grew out of the liturgy. The Catholic Church is the source of art. There's a reason for that, and the reason for that is, I think, art is one of the ways in which man is allowed to worship his Creator, and again have a glimpse of the glory of that Creator by creating. There is the sense that we are here on this earth to save our souls. We are humble servants, and humility is very important. We are creatures of God. We are created beings. But we have been given certain blessings, and among those blessings is the ability to create things ourselves. Now, the greatest gift that our Creator gave to us, of course, is the ability to propagate, to extend that creation. The order that was given directly, go forth and multiply. Adam and Eve being told, go out there and create new human life. And that is, the most important act of creation of mankind on this earth. But there are also other ways in which mankind has always created. Now, it is quite possible to take that creation on the level of the craftsman. If you look around this room, there are a number of tables, there are chairs. All of these were designed by someone and built by someone and built according to rules of craft. That is, if the legs of the chair had been placed on the top of the chair as opposed to the bottom of the chair would not be useful for its purpose, that is, to sit upon. There are rules of crafting, and the craftsman has to know those rules and build in an appropriate way and build correctly so that the object is useful. Now, as opposed to this good, sturdy, honest chair that's here before us, well crafted, there are occasionally artists. We think of the great 18th century furniture maker named Chippendale. And there is a thing called the Chippendale chair, and people spend a lot of money trying to acquire these objects. It has the same function as this. If you were simply looking for some place to sit down, there is no difference between this chair, a camp stool, and a Chippendale chair. But the reason that the Chippendale chair goes for a lot more money, has more value, is more highly honored, is because the craftsman extended his craft and made a beautiful object. There is something particularly beautiful in that chair, and suddenly craft was transcended and became art. And we can move beyond craftsmanship to artistry. And artistry always has at its core the reflection of a high beauty, of something that is higher than us, of something that is beautiful, that gets reflected in the created object. Now, it is true in music, it is true in art, it is certainly true in literature. And any artist giving expression to that is on one level simply a maker, on another level a craftsman, but the higher the level of craft, the greater the inspiration, we call it. And inspiration, meaning that which moved the artist to create in a certain way. The higher that level of inspiration, of course, knowing your Latin, you know that inspiration means quite literally to breathe into. So that the artist who is most highly inspired, we could say, has had more breath of the divine breathed into him than someone who is a simple craftsman. There is more of a connection to that divine vision. That divine vision reflecting three things. You're going to hear this over and over again during the entire seminar. That which is true, that which is good, that which is beautiful. And the greatest art in reflecting divinity is reflecting those attributes of the Godhead. God being all truth, all goodness, all beauty. So that the created object that manifests itself in this world and reflects that which is true, that which is good, and that which is beautiful will be a reflection of the divine and as a result draw us to it in the same way that the healthy soul is drawn to God. So that the created object, the work of art, can, if you will, become a kind of magnet to draw souls toward the ultimate. Now, it can do it in many different ways, and art in and of itself is not religion, okay? The distinction that was made earlier is true. Art is a separate thing. It's what artists do. Art is that which artists make. A painter paints, a musician composes, and a writer writes. And in doing that, they are concerned with their craft, but if they do it well, and if they do it to the top of their form, then they are giving an added dimension. They are creating something that often can be timeless, something that will transcend time, something that will speak across boundaries, it will not just be localized, something that will speak to all people, that will be more universal. And as a result, because of this, again, we have certain attributes of that which transcend this mundane world in which we find ourselves. Now, we're going to be looking particularly at literature, and that's what I want to focus on in these introductory remarks, because literature is unique. It's different from the other things. Music is its own thing. Sculpture is its own thing. Painting its own thing. We're looking at literature. Something curious happened to me over the weekend. I had been thinking about how I wanted to introduce the subject of literature. God works in very mysterious ways. This is a true story. I'm not making this up. There's someone in the room who can verify the truth of this story. I went out for lunch on Saturday noon to a rather nice little restaurant that serves good burgers. It's not easy these days to find a good burger in the land of the Golden Arches, but they're out there, but you have to go hunting for them. So I went to this little restaurant in downtown Eau Claire, and it's an upscale restaurant to draw in the smart young set. I don't belong to that, but nevertheless, I pay for my burger. They like my money. They'll let me in. And one of the things they've done to make it upscale is, they have some nice fixtures. It's light enough to see, but it's quiet lighting and dark walls and bookcases lining the entire restaurant. And the bookshelf, so you're sitting down at a table, next to you is an old bookshelf filled with old books. They're there for decoration. The assumption is, of course, nobody reads anymore, but isn't it sort of quaint to go into this restaurant that's reflecting a time gone by when they had these things called books, and the books sat on bookshelves, and so we eat our burgers and we feel very upscale, and we can go home and say, friends, I had a good meal tonight, and I sat next to books. It was very interesting. Old books, quaint old books. Well, of course, I sat down and immediately started going over, what's here? And there, dairy reports from the state of Wisconsin from 1883, there was a lot of exciting reading there. But I came upon a book called English Literature, so of course I grabbed it off the shelf. I then looked at the front, and it's English Literature written by Brother Leo. Now I'm interested, so I opened up the book. A survey and a commentary by Brother Leo of the Brothers of the Christian School, St. Mary's College, California, published in 1928. I'm very interested now, so I flip open at random and start looking at passages. And what we have is a book written by, I would guess, a good Catholic soul in years gone by, who's talking good sense. Wherever I turned, this book is filled with good sense. The waitress was quite overcome when she came up and handed us the bill, and I said, I want to buy this book. What does it cost? And she said, no one's ever asked this before. Nobody's ever taken one of these books off the shelf. She said, I have to go find the owner. I don't know what to do. So she takes the book and goes to the owner, and she hands it to him, and I see her phrase the question, and the owner is absolutely stymied. And he takes the book and he looks at it as if maybe there's something hidden in here. Maybe he discovered cash in the pages. Why does he want this book? And eventually she comes back and says, the owner says, it's yours. You may have it. I said, thank him very much. God works in mysterious ways. I'm going to run through for you from Brother Leo's book published in 1928 a section. I'm just going to give you high points called Why We Read Literature. I found this on a bookshelf in a restaurant last Saturday. This is good stuff. This is good, solid Catholic thought. Number one, heading, Why We Read Literature. Number one, to vitalize our knowledge. to vitalize our knowledge. Vitalize meaning to infuse life into what we know. Now let me say before I get into this, I'm going to explain this. There's a beautiful passage here I'm going to read to you, but let me begin by just explaining. If we are to go all the way back to the Greeks, through the Romans, up to the Middle Ages, through the Renaissance, and even to some of the best modern writers, one of my favorites, the British novelist, some of you know him, Evelyn Waugh, you will find artists saying very much the same thing, and they have two basic reasons for what they do. Two basic things that they all say literature should do. Number one is to educate. Literature exists in order to tell us something, to educate us in the sense of educare, which means to lead. A good work of literature leads us somewhere, takes us somewhere where we haven't been, or explains something that we didn't know before. One is to educate, and the other is to delight. There is in literature the enjoyment factor. Just simply enjoying the process of the story, of storytelling, okay? I forgot to bring down a Bible with me. Is there one here? Anybody, by any chance? Yeah, that's a book you can't ask for here. You could, if you walked into the restaurant and asked for English Literature by Brother Leo, they wouldn't know they had it. If you come to the seminary and ask for a Bible, there's a good chance you're going to find one. While the Bible is coming, two separate functions for literature that have always been claimed for it. Number one, that sense of to educate, to tell us things we don't know, to give us information we need to have. And literature is a way of doing it, and one reason it's an appropriate way of doing it is because of the second reason, which is literature delights us. A good story interests us. And it's easier to remember what we've been told if it's told in the form of a good story. It's just simply that it will stay in our heads longer. If I give you a list of things to remember, chances are you might forget the list. If I put that list in story form, there's a better chance you'll remember the story, and remembering the story, remembering the parts of the story, you'll remember the information that the story was to convey. Thank you very much. Let me underline that in the following way. I'm looking at the Gospel of St. Matthew, the 13th chapter. It's an important moment for those of us who teach literature. And there are those who say it's not a serious study. It's ancillary. It's not really that important. It's not like algebra or mechanical engineering. What's the point? What's the point of reading these stories? But this is very nice. This is the 13th chapter. It's the parable of the sower and the seed. Okay, you know the parable very well. I won't go through the parable, where Christ is teaching and says, "Behold, the sower went forth to sow," and he tells about where the seed falls. And in the midst of it, his disciples came and said to him, "Why speakest thou to them in parables?" And it's a genuine question. It's a question that in a more mundane, practical way, I still get, why do future naval officers have to read Shakespeare? Why do you have them reading books? What's the point of reading stories? The disciples are saying to our Lord, "Lord, you have things to teach them, but why don't you just tell them directly? Why don't you just say, look, here's what you need to know. Here's the list." You know? They asked the question, "Why speakest thou to them in parables?" "Who answered and said to them, because to you it is given to know the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven, but to them it is not given." Look, you're walking with me. You are understanding these things directly, but most people cannot understand the mysteries of the kingdom of heaven directly. Cannot do it in a direct line. "For he that hath, to him shall be given, and he shall abound. But he that hath not, from him shall be taken away that also which he hath. Therefore do I speak to them in parables, because seeing they see not, and hearing they hear not, neither do they understand. And the prophecy of Isaiah is fulfilled in them who saith, by hearing you shall hear and shall not understand, and seeing you shall see and shall not perceive. For the heart of this people is grown gross, and with their ears they have been dull of hearing, and their eyes they have shut, lest at any time they should see with their eyes and hear with their ears and understand with their heart and be converted, and I should heal them. But blessed are your eyes because they see, and your ears because they hear. And for amen, I say to you, I'm just finishing out the passage, many prophets and just men have desired to see the things that you see and have not seen them, and to hear the things that you hear and have not heard them. Hear you therefore the parable of the sower. Your eyes have grown gross. Your ears have become closed. You cannot get these things directly. And before you can understand, the eyes have to be slowly opened, the ears have to be slowly made to hear, and in order to do that, it must be given to you in a way that is pleasant, that delights, that you can begin to take in, and then you will get the knowledge that is being imparted, but you can't get it directly. Now, if that was true of the world 2,000 years ago, how much truer is it of us today? And the fact of the matter is, I would make the claim, we need stories more now than ever. But I would also say God in his wisdom prepared this time, prepared the human race for the coming of his son who would speak in parables by imparting to us a desire to listen to stories. It is innate in us. One of the things that defines humanity from the dawn is, whether you want to take that old vision of Og the caveman who went out with his club and just bopped some animal on the head and hauled it home and built a fire, he was also painting pictures on the wall and probably sitting grunting trying to tell what happened when he went out and bopped this animal on the head and the difficulty he had dragging it home. He needed to tell that story. And the others would sit around and grunt in appreciation. Now, we went beyond that, fortunately, but I would say that primal desire is still in us. We need to tell what has happened. We need to tell what's out there. But we also like to make up stories. An indication of it, any of you who have spent time around children, especially little children, from the moment they can put sentences together, out has come the phrase, "Tell me a story, Daddy." And it's not just a diversion to keep from going to bed. Occasionally it's that, but there also seems to be a basic need there. I want to hear a story. And in fact, tell me a good story. And this I find particularly interesting. Tell me that story you told me last night. And once you finish it, tell it to me again. We need to hear the same stories over and over and over again, somehow implying that the repeated story, the story told repeatedly, sinks deeper, land somewhere inside, is able to be dealt with and better understood. So that the parable was the way our Lord himself taught the people. It was necessary for our Lord to tell these little stories in order to give the most important, in order to give the good news, in order to let people know what they needed to know. He told stories. Storytelling, in a way, then, has a very honorable imprimatur on it. And those of us who teach literature can be proud of teaching literature, even if the level is not that of the parable of our Lord himself. Nevertheless, the story is honorable. Now, I'm back to Brother Leo. Why we read literature? To vitalize our knowledge. There's the first one. It gives us knowledge, but Brother Leo was a smart cookie. He goes one step further. Literature is not just there to give us knowledge. Listen to this. This is good. To know is one thing. To realize is another. Realization implies vitalized knowledge. I may know, for instance, that Assisi is a town somewhere in Italy, and that St. Francis lived there and founded the Friars Minor. I may know several of the events in the saint's life and have read a number of the interesting legends about the first Franciscans. I may be able to cite the dates of St. Francis's birth and death and canonization, and to tell you how many Franciscans there now are throughout the world. All that is knowledge. Facts. Just give me the facts. Then let us suppose that one day I find myself in Umbria and climb the hill whereon Assisi stands. I walk the same narrow streets through which the saint used to trip singing in the days of his youth. I kneel at his tomb in the great church raised in his honor and gaze upon the story of his life as depicted by the artist Giotto. Then I walk down the olive-clad hill and across the sunset fields to visit the noble basilica which encloses the tiny 700-year-old chapel of the Portiuncula. Let us suppose finally that in the moonlight I sit and ponder upon the spirit of love and simplicity and holy gladness which the little poor man, as he called himself, kindled so long ago in that very place, and which still burns mightily throughout the world, and that thinking thus, I resolve to make the Franciscan spirit a part of my own life and to shed love and joy about me everywhere, then I shall not merely know, but realize the significance of Assisi and its saint. My knowledge will be alive, vital. In other words, knowledge confined to the intellect is dead, but it comes to life when it is realized, that is, when it arouses an emotional response and stirs the will to action. That's wonderful stuff. It's wonderful stuff. It's the reason why it is possible to be a walking encyclopedia filled with facts and still not hold real wisdom. Wisdom is knowledge vitalized that reaches into the heart as well as the head and causes the will to act, to do something about. Now, it's again what literature does. What does literature do? It can give us information. It can give us information. But what it really does, because of the emotional power of the literary artifact, it can turn that knowledge into something lived, experienced, and then reinforced in the world. Okay? Now, that's his first. Why we read literature? To vitalize our knowledge. Knowledge is not enough. It needs to be sparked into action. Number two, to live more deeply and richly. This is interesting. To live more deeply and richly. In that very idea is the recognition that, yes, we live a life. I got up this morning, I went to the chapel, I attended Mass, I went and ate some breakfast, I walked around a little bit, I'm here now. Those are the events of my life. And my life can be chronicled that way in terms of a series of incidents. I did A, then I did B, then I went here, and okay, series of incidents. But we also can live in another way. We can live in another way. I had a very dear friend. She was a neighbor who was in her 60s when I was born. I grew up knowing her. She was always nearby. We were dear friends. She never, from the day she married at the age of 18, spent a night outside of her own house. She never went anywhere. She didn't want to. And yet, as she said, well, I don't need to go. God gave me the ability to read. And she loved reading books. Not only that, she had a capacity to memorize. She could sit. We timed her once. She sat and recited for 3 hours before I got tired of listening to her and made her stop. She said much of it was things she had learned in school. But what she had was a rich interior life. And literature provides for an interior life. When I read Hamlet, I suddenly am experiencing an entire range of events that I personally will never know. They will not be a part of my lived life externally in the sense of my action. I will never be Prince of Denmark. My uncle will never kill my father. Hasn't happened yet. Seems unlikely. My mother will never marry my uncle. That's even more unlikely. Okay, these are all events that take place in that play that don't... I hope I will never stab someone blindly through an arris without knowing who's on the other side. I hope I will never drive my fiance mad by ill-treating her. I mean, there are a whole list of things there that I am wiser for knowing. These are things I need to know. Having experienced them through Hamlet, having lived deeply and richly, not just the good things, but the troubling times through Hamlet, wisdom can come to me, and I don't have to be out there and live it. I'm going to get into this, obviously, later this morning, when we head down into the pits of hell. All right? I'm going to talk later about how encountering all those sinners in hell, Dante gains necessary information without having to commit all those sins. And when we read Dante and spiral down through those circles of the inferno, we are gaining knowledge, we are living deeply and richly, vicariously, and getting things we must know and experiencing emotions and torments that aid us in living, but fortunately, we don't have to go through it directly. Second reason, to live more deeply and richly. But part of that life, again, is the interior life that literature can provide. Brother Leo, I quote Brother Leo again. I feel like he's an old friend. I just met him on Saturday. By the way, it's interesting, too. Very Catholic, I would claim medieval. There is not one word here about who he was. Not a word about him. Just Brother Leo. And apparently he was at this college in California in 1928. Beyond that, not a word. Unlike modern authors, you open the books, and my favorite was, I have a copy of Pascal's Pensées that I teach in class sometimes. There's a tiny little biography of Pascal and a full page about the translator. It's just wonderful. That's modern man. Brother Leo's not a modern man. Brother Leo was medieval. I don't know anything about him. Wise man, though. Here he is again. The soul, the mind, needs food and exercise just as the body does. But the food of the mind is not bread, and its exercise is not games. It feeds on visions of truth and beauty as supplied by the master word artists in literature. Its exercise is to wrestle with ideas enshrined in noble books, even as Jacob wrestled all the night with the angel. And its reward is, like Jacob's, to receive a joyful blessing at the dawn. This Brother Leo could write too. That's a lovely little image. Now it's true. There it is. You have to feed the soul. You have to feed the mind. And it much of the time it's a good thing if it's good solid beefsteak. Okay. It's healthier to chew on that. It's hard work. It's not easy. But there's another sense in which, and St. Thomas Aquinas says this, that the soul needs refreshment, just as the body needs rest. So that there are certain kinds of literature we can read that are not serious and deep and scholarly. They tend toward the enjoyment side of the factor. Pleasure. Delightful pleasure. A good story well told. Because the soul and the mind need that refreshment. But there are other times when they need training, and indeed, If you're only giving dessert to the brain and the soul, it will grow fat in the same way if you do not exercise your body. I'll stop right there. I quote Brother Leo again. A man physically ill has no appetite for beefsteak and onions, and no thrill at the prospect of taking part in a football game or a marathon race. Boy, I understand that. I'm not physically ill, but the thought, if I were to have to go to the Olympics and participate in any of the events, there not only would be no medal given, but I would be in misery, okay? Point being, if you're not trained for it, if you're not ready to do it, you can't do it. He makes the same claim. Often a reader does not get much benefit from reading a masterpiece of literature simply because he does not give himself to the work with vim, vigor, and enthusiasm. He must take an active, not a passive attitude toward the great writer and the great book. He must read creatively. Right reading is a form of living. Wonderful. But the principal complaint I hear from my students all the time, no matter what I give them, and I tend to toss big books their way, you know. Don Quixote and Moby Dick and King Lear. And they'll all, the initial reaction is they'll come in, having made perhaps a 15, 20 minute attempt to read some of it. And they'll say, this is boring. This is so boring. And one of the nice things about teaching over many years is you work out responses to these things, you know, because they don't realize you've heard this before regularly. So my response is always, you've made a mistake. Moby Dick is not boring. Great art is a great mirror. You are boring. Whereupon they, you know, then they're taken aback. Shuts them right up. It's the old Russian proverb that the great artist Nikolai Gogol quotes. Don't blame the mirror if your face is crooked. which is good. Point being, you encounter a great book, you know. I find Dante boring. You know, he would be so upset to learn that. You know, for 700 years now, for 700 years, the finest minds have found him one of the greatest sources of enlightenment as to what life is about and the overall design of the universe. And now you come along, 18-year-old student, and say, this is boring. You know, thank God he's not here to hear that. It would shatter his heart. You know, it's just, get out of here. But the point that Brother Leo makes on a more polite level, good brother that he is that there are people who simply, you know, If you take someone who has only eaten cotton candy for 18 years and throw him a beefsteak, he'll choke on it. And the fact of the matter is what he's getting for the first time is real food. Iron and minerals and protein and, you know, but the teeth are gone from the sugar that's rotted them away. Try gumming a beefsteak sometime. It's just, you know, it's an unpleasant experience. The mind that encounters great literature and says, I really don't like this, is the man with no teeth gumming a beefsteak. That's the equivalent. Now, here's one. Here's number three. To acquire culture. Culture is a dirty word now, especially in universities. You know, you do not want to be cultured. Culture represents that of the past, which is disgraceful and shameful. We'll get into some of this later. I'll give you some examples of it. This is stated very simply. I'm not going to dwell on this. I think it's a clear idea. Through religion and art, music and literature, the man of culture comes into vital contact with ideas of truth, beauty, and goodness. Because the emotions aroused in him by those refining influences are noble and elevated. And the whole point of exposing oneself to these great things is quite literally to elevate. And when an entire body or populace jointly decides these things are of value, focuses on them, gets to know them, you have culture in that everything is elevated. Or we can go back to cultus, which, again, culture, agriculture means to grow crops. If you have a cultured society, it means you have grown as a people. You have ennobled yourselves. You've elevated yourselves. Whereas, if I simply went out and threw rocks and pebbles into the dirt and let it sit there and came back some months later and wondered why there was no corn, the fault would be mine. In the same way, year after year after year of Gilligan's Island reruns or putrid movies like Independence Day, some other time, ask me about my experience at Independence Day. I had to flee from it. I'll tell you about it some other time. But generation after generation getting that is you're going to end up with a barren field. Nothing's going to grow. Why? Because it's the equivalent of just tossing whatever you feel like into the field and not doing any work. And there will be nothing there. And then suddenly you'll find yourself starving. Suddenly you'll have barbarism. Suddenly you'll have young children bringing guns to school. Suddenly you'll have, and this was a statistic, 25% of eighth graders saying they had tried marijuana. Suddenly you'll have suicides. The suicide rate between 12-year-olds and those between 12 and 18 years old has tripled in the last 15 years. That's a barren field. There wasn't even any seed scattered there. We can't even see it fell on rock. We're not even scattering the seed anymore. Fact of the matter is, if you're given something, okay, religion, art, music, and literature, they're not equivalent. Each one is different, but these are things that are necessary. The man of culture comes into vital contact with the ideas of truth, beauty, and goodness because the emotions aroused in him by those refining influences are noble and elevated. It follows that his habits of thinking and feeling are formed under the influence of the best and finest ideals. Such a man has the dignity and the simplicity, the ease and the self-control, the poise and the independence, the strength and the gentility, which are the external indications of inner culture. I really like Brother Leo. Here's his last one. This is good. This is very good. Finally, to learn the art of self-expression. To learn the art of self-expression. Let's look at it on the highest level. I'll talk about it in another way in a moment, but tomorrow we'll be talking about T.S. Eliot, one of the masters of our own time. Eliot wrote a fascinating essay, a prose essay, in which he talks about how the artist becomes an artist. It doesn't just happen. The essay is called Tradition and the Individual Talent. And the point of Eliot's essay begins with the first word of the title, tradition. You cannot hope to do anything if you go out on your own, cut away from all of those things that have gone before, and seek to do it purely as an individual. Whatever you accomplish has got to be built on tradition, and before you begin building, you better get that foundation, and the foundation is represented by all those great writers and artists who went before you. So that Eliot, wanting to be a poet, spent years studying, and I mean studying, all those other poets who had preceded him. That is hard work. It's much easier just to sit down and grab a pen and sort of just spew it out on the paper, you know. Just let the words just pour all over the paper. Now, it can be useful at times, just the exercise of writing, but if you really want to develop ideas, you got to go to the past. You have to see what those giants who preceded you did, and maybe you'll be able to crawl up on their shoulders someday, maybe. But even if not that, you certainly will develop and master the art of expressing yourself. You may not become a great poet, but you'll become someone who can give expression to ideas and thoughts with clarity and conviction. And self-expression is extremely important because we are creatures of language. It is one of the principal things that separates us from the animals, although again my students quarrel with me on this one. The dolphins can talk. I'll save this. We'll get to this when we hit Moby Dick. Let me just say here, the fact of the matter is, we use language in a way different from the dolphins. If they do squeak and the squeaks mean something, we cannot know. And they're certainly not doing what we do. We were given the word. And those of us who are traditionalists are still lucky enough to have the last gospel at the end of every Mass. And that image, that vision, that truth about the Word descending, the Word incarnate, on the grand spiritual scale, also connects with the fact that we possess language, that we were given the gift of language with which to express, understand, and become creatures of reason. It's an extremely important gift. It's part of what makes us human, and we need to master that. And it takes work. If you put a little child on a bicycle, the bicycle will fall over and the child will cry. And yet riding a bicycle is something worth learning, but you know what it takes. It takes the training wheels and it takes time and it takes falling over and it takes the cuts and it takes the bruises. The same is absolutely true of learning to use language. And eventually it can become second nature and you get on it. And yeah, off you go and you can sail and you're not even thinking of it, but there's still a distance between able to get on your bike and ride three blocks and being able to survive the Tour de France. There are some cyclists who are cyclists. There are the rest of us that can still balance without training wheels, okay? But the fact of the matter is there is a basic degree of competence that is there. It's especially true of human speech. Human speech is part of the music we make, and we're going to get into poetry almost immediately. Poetry is human speech as music. It's the place, it's the meeting ground between literature and music. We'll come to that later. Now, those are a few just basics. Those are just a few basics of what literature does for us. I would say something else, and let me put this directly to those of you who are seminarians studying for the priesthood. I go back to that notion of experience again. You are spending important years of your life within the confines of the seminary. That is necessary. It is a good and necessary thing. But the fact of the matter is, and many of you know this, there are experiences out there that you are not having, that you are not meant to have, that you should not have, that you don't have time to have, that once you get out of here, you're going to run into immediately. Because while you're in here, and there's a reason why I come and hide out here every so often. It's to regain that sense of calm and quiet and sanity in order to put order in the soul and the mind. But I can assure you that's not going on out in the world. Quite the contrary is the case. You need to have some sense of what's going on out there. You need to have a human awareness of the range of human possibilities. Literature can provide that. Good literature can provide that. Because there is no point in wasting your time being told lies or half-truths or simply badly expressed fumbled attempts at something by somebody who can't do it. I got on an airplane recently. Well, it was when I flew out here last fall to lecture on The Winter's Tale. I got on the airplane, and every single person on the airplane was reading a John Grisham novel. Everyone! It was amazing. It was like the publisher had come and handed them out up and down the aisles. And what happens occasionally is these popular artists rise up, and I'm saying there's not necessarily anything wrong with reading a John Grisham novel, except it's pure cotton candy. It may be entertaining, it may be fun, but two things. One, he's not the best, doesn't really care to be the best, and once the money starts flowing in, you know, turn him out. Look at poor Stephen King, you know. He has to write at least one book before breakfast, two before lunch, and get another one done at dinner before he goes to bed. You know, turning out four books a day means the quality suffers. There comes the point where you're not writing anymore, you're a factory. You're a book factory. This is what happens to many writers. That's too bad. Second of all, the skill isn't there. The insight isn't there. And sadly, you've only got so much time. You've only got so much time. It's the argument I make with my students who say, you know, but sir, this new rock band is really good. You should listen to them. I swear to you, Puss Casserole is the best rock band to come along in years. They know music, they turn out good music, you'd really like them. And my response is, there are Mozart string quartets I don't know yet. That I've never had a chance to listen to. And you know, look at me, the ticker's giving out someday soon. I should sit now and listen to Puss Casserole when I don't know all of Mozart's string quartets? I mean, look, time is limited. Give me a break. If you can bring me a certificate from my doctor saying I've got another three, if I'm going to outdo Methuselah, you bring me that, and then by gum, I might take an afternoon and listen to Puss Casserole, but right now, now. It's home to Mozart and those four little stringed instruments, and that'll be fine, thank you. You know. Time is limited. Your time is limited. You need the best. You need the best. And it's very simple. How do I know what's the best? You turn to tradition. You have to trust those who have gone before you, who have read through this stuff, who have, if you will, winnowed it out for you, and the chaff is blown away, and we're left with the wheat, and the wheat is there, and the wheat is what, you know, the wheat is very simple. I have students who say, make me up a list. I say, I don't need to make you up a list. Go to the library, and those books that are old that haven't yet been thrown out are worth reading. Homer and Sophocles and Virgil and Dante and Chaucer and Shakespeare, they're still there. And then they sort of look like, oh, you know. And the reason they go, oh, I don't know, is because they know right away, oh, hard work. Oh, it's going to be hard. Oh, I don't have any teeth. Don't tell me to eat beefsteak. Fact of the matter is, once you've chewed through it, the taste is great. And suddenly, it's not just that you feel better. It's not just that you feel better, because again, literature is not just beefsteak. But suddenly you're going to discover you came for beefsteak and you got the lemon meringue pie at the same time. And that was pretty fine too. It's both of those. It's both of those. I have used up all of my time. I don't want to start Dante right now. Let me just say this. Little quick vision of what we're doing this week. I'm starting with Dante, and I'm going to be very schematic with the Inferno. When we gather at 11 o'clock, I'm going to disappoint all of you. Okay? So you can come back with that excited, anticipatory reaction that's going to be the most boring thing you've ever heard. Because what I'm going to do is just give you a schematic approach. Okay, fine. I sit down with a book. What do I do with it? All right? And I'm going to use the Inferno to get us in. So it means I'm gonna leave out all the good parts. This afternoon we can talk about all the good parts. We're gonna start out with just how do I approach a book? What do I do with a book? But we're starting with Dante. I'll quote the great T.S. Eliot, who not just the great poet of our time, but undoubtedly the greatest critic as well, who said, I love this statement, Dante and Shakespeare divide the world between them. There is no third, which is very nice. Which means if you only have time to read two people, then read Dante and Shakespeare. And you'll get it all. I mean, it's all there. One, the great spiritual writer, the other, the great secular writer. Although they, of course, that's not exclusive. That's not exclusive. Dante certainly had his secular knowledge and Shakespeare his spiritual side. But boy, there you've got it. So we're starting with Dante. We'll start each of the 3 weeks with Dante. And then in between Dante and moving to Shakespeare on Wednesday, we're going to do some Eliot tomorrow. A very great man and closely connected with Dante. Eliot is more closely connected with Dante than with Shakespeare. Quite different. So today Dante, we'll talk about the Inferno. Tomorrow, and we need to check this probably this afternoon, Lieutenant Childs will be talking about Eliot's The Hollow Men and Ash Wednesday tomorrow. So we need to see how many of you need copies of that. We can get some Xerox copies made, so you'll have copies to look at. This is to head us into the four quartets. And then Wednesday, taking up Othello. I'm going to 2 days on Othello. Good luck. I will fail miserably at that. This is planning ahead. I'll fail miserably at that. And then on Friday, we're going to look at the great 19th century operatic version of Othello, Verdi's Otello. So that's what's coming up. Well, I didn't quite get to it. We'll take some time, chat among yourselves, run screaming around, and regret that you came here. But at 11 o'clock, I'll be back here to bore you with the Inferno, if that's possible. Yes.